Welcome to the Shame Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame Free Zone is a safe place for your questions
and
your secrets
about
all things sexual.
Hey, we're coming to you right from the Tahoe National Forest, and we're not on fire yet. Oh, well, maybe our topic is so. Anyway, thanks for tuning in. My guest tonight is Corey Silverberg. Corey is one of three authors of a fantastic book about handicaps, or I prefer to say differently, abled people, and sex. And Corey, welcome to the show, and why don't you tell me about your book?
Oh, okay. Well, thanks for having me. The name of the book is The Ultimate Guide to Sex and Disability. We usually talk about people living with disabilities. Sometimes people who live with disabilities sometimes refer to themselves as disabled people in the same way that sort of different groups have reclaimed terms like queer or sort of dyke or words that sometimes get used to hurt people now are sort of being reclaimed.
About that term differently abled?
I don't love it so much because the thing is that everyone is differently abled, right? It's sort of
right.
It actually doesn't, you know, one of the weird things, the interesting things about talking about sex and disability is, you know, a lot of issues are the same regardless of if you live with a disability or not, and then some issues are not, and it's important to sort of realize what those differences are. You know, like, you know, we all have a hard time getting the sex we want, but if I go through the world and I look very different, if I have a visible disability, the fact is I'm treated pretty differently. One of my favorite disability activists, this guy named Tom Shakespeare, always says that the real problem when you're disabled is not to figure out how to have sex, it's to figure out who to have sex with. And that's actually often the case. I mean, I think non-disabled people often sort of think, well, you know, how could you have sex if you have no arms, or how could you have sex if you can't move your legs? But that kind of stuff usually isn't the biggest obstacle. So anyway, I mean, but, you know, the other thing I should say is, you know, everyone uses different language, and I really encourage people, I myself am currently non-disabled, and what I really encourage people to do is, you know, use language that feels right and be open to hear someone say, you know, that's not the word I like to use, and know that, you know, using the wrong word is not going to be the thing that prevents you from making a friend or finding a lover or hopping in bed with someone. You know, I mean, we can get pretty hung up on language, and it's important, but it's actually not probably the most important thing.
Yeah, now I actually got into a little bit of trouble with one of the people who had attended one of my lecture presentations in Miami last month because I was talking about my understanding of quadriplegia, which I've had my very first boyfriend, the guy I lost my virginity to, fell off of a roof. He was a construction worker.
Okay.
And he fell off of a roof and was paralyzed from the neck down.
Okay.
So he really didn't have the use of his arms or his legs.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had a client when I was working as an escort who also fell off of a roof. I don't know what the theme is here. But in his case, he was dropping acid in the 60s and apparently thought he could fly.
Shit.
So when I met him, he was in a wheelchair and didn't have the use of his arms or legs either.
Right.
But this particular person defined himself as quadriplegic and was upset because I was saying that if you were quadriplegic, you didn't have sensation from the neck down, which meant that you wouldn't be able to achieve an erection.
Right.
So maybe you can help me understand what some of the differences are there?
Sure. Well, you know, the main thing I want to tell you is that there are very few rules, right? So traditionally, the way that sort of medicine and even sexual health education in the 60s and 70s and even 80s talked about sex and disability was kind of the way you're talking, which is sort of, you know, if you have this disability, probably your sexuality will kind of look like this. And this is the way most of the research was written up. And in fact, the way that, you know, when I was trained as a sex educator, that was sort of the way I was trained, was like disability A equals sexuality B. But the fact is that you just need to kind of throw all that out the window, because I can tell you the number of friends that I have who have been told, who live with disabilities, who were told you'll never have an orgasm, who then have had orgasms, it's staggering. I mean,
wow.
I mean, you know, the thing is,
I would never say that, but then I don't think you need genitals to have an orgasm.
Right. Well. Okay. But most people aren't as enlightened as you are.
thank you. Corey.
You're welcome. We've just met, but I have a sense.
How about just experience? I don't know that it's enlightenment. I've just seen people have orgasms. They don't need genitals to do.
That's great. And the thing is, of course, unfortunately, not everyone has enough experience to see, like, oh, right, it can happen all different ways. So,
yeah.
So the thing is that, you know, I mean, when you talk about people who are quadriplegic, the issues around spinal cord injury really depend on the level of injury, so where the spinal cord is severed, if it's a complete injury, and there's all sorts of differences. And there's interesting effects. Like, there are people who may have no genital sensation, but have, there's a term called sacral sparing. I think sacral sparing is what it is, where actually they'll have sensation sometimes around the anus, and they'll have sensation on the bottom of their feet.
Oh, wow.
So that's one thing. I mean, another interesting
thing. You have a lot of fun with an anus and soles
and
of the bottom
feet. I know, exactly. That's like at least one night. The other thing that, you know, that's interesting to know about people who suffer paralysis and have no or reduced sensation on some parts of their bodies, the level at which the sensation begins,
uh-huh,
often just above it is actually a term they call hypersensitive. And in fact, those are often spaces where people will very easily be able to be stimulated to orgasm. So the point above, I mean, again, if you have an injury and you're paralyzed and you have no sensation at a certain level, the point above it is often much more intensely pleasurable, and you're much more aware of it than a lot of people that have what, quote-unquote, full sensation.
Huh.
A funny story is just that there's like an old story that nurses tell about new nurses on a ward in a rehab hospital, and there's one new nurse who goes to her fellow nurses and says, you know, it's going pretty well, but it's really funny because the guys, they want their teeth brushed like 4 or 5 times a day, and all the nurses laugh at her because the thing is that there are people who, again, you can have spots of hypersensitivity, and there are people who can have orgasms from having kind of their gums rubbed. So, in fact, in this particular case,
I totally get that. I had the client that I had that was in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
Had become orgasmic through his earlobes and his neck.
For sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, so the thing is, I think probably the person in the audience was probably just responding to sort of the fact that their experience, particularly in the medical system, is of being told, this is what you're going to be like, right? This is all you can expect. And, I mean, this is stuff that you'll understand just, you know, working in sexuality. I mean, that's the way the medical system deals with sexuality, period, right?
They don't deal with it at all, really.
Right. And
if they can neuter you, that makes life so much easier for them.
Exactly.
They've only, you know, I got certified as a sex educator through San Francisco Sex Information.
Mm-hmm.
That's a 60-hour workshop.
Mm-hmm.
That's 5 times what your average medical doctor gets.
I know.
I think is scary because it was a really intense, thorough workshop. But to tell you the truth, the 14 years of hands-on was, you know, that's invaluable.
Absolutely
invaluable. And I'm thinking one-fifth of that.
And you are
a doctor, and you're going to be telling people about their sex lives. That's really scary.
The thing you always just tell people is don't ask your doctor about your sex life.
Yes.
I mean, you can, but just be careful. Of course, there are some actually really great doctors. I mean, one of the co-authors of the book is a doctor, but she's chosen over the course of her career to get herself trained, right?
Oh, I think that's. Let's talk about your co-authors,
sure.
So we don't forget to mention them.
Okay. Well, one of them is Dr. Miriam Kaufman, and she's actually a doctor in Toronto at a hospital called Sick Kids Hospital. So she actually mostly works with youth and teens, a lot of stuff around disability and mostly around sexuality. And then the other co-author is Fran Odette, who's a social worker who lives with a disability and a very long-standing disability activist. So the three of us kind of come to the book with different experiences. One of us lives with a chronic illness. One of us has a disability. One of us, meaning me, is non-disabled. All of us have had partners with disabilities and sort of have disability as a big part of our kind of personal and professional life. But really the best part of the book, you know, I have to say, is that we based it on a survey we did, but it was sort of this long-form survey. We asked people to tell us, people living with disabilities, to tell us their sex stories, good and bad. And then those are kind of sort of put in throughout the book. And that's, I mean, you know, I mean, the information that we give is obviously very good, and I'm, you know, I tend not to say too many good things about myself, so I probably put that stuff down a little bit, but really what I think is so invaluable are the stories, because that's what we don't hear. I mean, one of the big one of the big barriers and obstacles for people living with disabilities is just that they have no sexual role models, right? There's nowhere to turn to see yourself presented as sexy.
No, and in fact, the popular media takes quite a bit of delight in lampooning the sexuality or potential sexuality of anybody who might be considered too short.
It's true.
Or is somebody who is too old, however the culture defines that.
Right, these days I think it's like over 35, sadly, which means I'm out.
I don't have to disagree with that. I think the culture's kind of gotten enamored with this whole cougar thing.
I guess so, but you know, but they deride the cougars. You know, I mean, the cougar thing, I find they're always still tittering. There's an attitude about it.
Yeah.
They think Sex and the City, they sort of say it makes it cool, but I think when I talk to sort of regular people, there's still this sort of embarrassment or shame or, you know, this idea that anyone over 35 could be boldly sexual is just embarrassing, which is, I mean, unfortunately, I mean, I don't know. Do you ever think it's going to get better?
Oh, I think it is.
Yeah, you think so? Oh,
absolutely.
Really?
I do.
I don't know. I'm not so hopeful. I mean, I think
I'll tell you why.
Yeah, tell me.
Just statistically, the baby boomers are redefining the aging process.
Yeah.
And the culture is having to shift in their direction more and more. So I just watch popular media, and I see how the longevity of musicians' careers,
mm-hmm.
something that never happened before the baby boomers.
That's true.
Who are still rocking and rolling in their 60s and 70s, which is, you know, no matter how you feel about it,
mm-hmm.
there's a market for it, and it's happening.
It's true. I mean, and I hope you're right. I mean, the thing is, I see, though, you know, when you look at all the commercials for Viagra and Cialis, they use much younger actors, right? So they're marketing to 50- and 60-year-old guys, and all of the actors are in their 40s.
That's true. But what? The sad thing about Cialis and Viagra is it has actually become a DOC, a drug of choice.
Yeah.
For guys in their 20s and 30s.
I know. Well, I know. I mean, part of the problem is that they do this advertising thing where now a guy who's in his 30s looks at the commercial and thinks, oh, I guess that is for me, even if he has no issues with erections.
Yeah. it's an enhancement drug.
That's
now.
Right. It's an enhancement drug.
It's not that they're having difficulties. It's that they want to get, you know, if some is good, more is better.
More is better. That's right. There's a really great, I should tell you, if you go to Consumer Reports, they've just started this new series called Consumer Watch, and what they do is they take drug commercials, like over-the-counter, you know, prescription drug ads, TV commercials, and they kind of take them apart, and they do it in a really funny and very interesting way, and they do one about Cialis, and it's just like, you know, and it just sort of takes apart, like, all of the problems of pushing these drugs.
Oh, yeah. No, I personally just think it's so unfortunate that people are going in the direction of always treating their bodies like machines.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of really cultivating connection with yourself, connection with spirit, and connection with others,
mm-hmm.
it just goes further and further into this whole I'm a machine and I want peak performance from my machine.
How do you feel about, I know probably you're supposed to be asking me the questions, but I'm just going to ask you one.
Go for it.
How do you feel like all that stuff, I mean, of course I agree with you completely, and what's your sense of what guys do with that when they go and see sex workers? Like, I mean, you know, I know that there are sex workers and escorts who obviously emphasize the connection and have a much more complicated understanding of sex. But because I know that this is something you talk of and write about and know a lot about, do you feel like the sex trade industry, you know, when we talk about the drug industry, I think they're part of the problem. In some ways, when we talk about another industry I'm involved in, which is sex toys,
uh-huh.
I also think they're sometimes part of the problem, but also can be part of the solution.
And basically you're positing the idea that the sex industry can also be part of the problem.
Well, that's why I'm what's your sense of that?
Well, this is my sense of it. So is marriage.
and
basically, as long as you're coming from a patriarchal paradigm, which mm-hmm. is mired in sexual shame,
mm-hmm.
we're always focused on this separation of spirit and sex.
Right.
And really, it's immaterial to me if somebody's getting paid for sex or somebody's got a wedding ring and a contract.
Mm-hmm.
The way that they approach it is usually so uninspired and disembodied
mm-hmm.
that, you know, I, that's why I have so much passion about trying to shift those paradigms.
Mm-hmm.
But the assumption that somehow or another, a couple of greenbacks is going to make something more banal than the routine that some married people can get into with each other, where they don't even talk to each other anymore and they just go through the motions, I think it's ludicrous. They both can just be incredibly empty maneuvers.
Mm-hmm.
But so I think we need to focus more on intention.
Right, right.
Why people do what they do.
Yeah, and I like what you said about the issue of shame. To think about tying it to shame, and that if the goal is to reduce that kind of shame, then whether you're paying for sex or you're in a committed bonded relationship, whatever it is, the sex would presumably be more meaningful, be more...
Yeah, it's the same approach that I have towards addiction. People ask me about sex addiction, and I go, well, first of all, sex, like food, is a necessary, important part of life.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want to make all of your sexual urges and behaviors suspect. What you want to do is find your perfect balance, and not somebody else's perfect balance, but your perfect balance, between the other aspects of your life and your sexuality. But some people, when they approach sex addiction, really try to indict particular sexual orientations and sexual behaviors.
Right, absolutely.
And I think that's just abhorrent. I'm like, so you want to indict anybody who does BDSM, anybody who sees a stripper or a prostitute, anybody who likes pornography, they're all sex addicts.
Mm-hmm, that's true.
And, I'm like, well, so anybody who eats a bagel is a food addict? I mean, what are you only carrots?
Right, right.
No, I think the point is that addictive behavior is addictive behavior, and it really doesn't matter what your relationship, your addictive relationship is with, whether it's a donut or a carrot. If you're addictive, you're addictive, and that's what you need to work on.
But we always treat sex differently. It's always worse when it's sex.
Yes, we do, because we have not taken that thing out to talk about it much.
No.
But I just found out, just read this a couple of weeks ago, and I was so, just very exciting news to me. They recently documented a female baby still inside the womb, so technically I think you'd call it a fetus, but I think it was at the stage of development where it was probably close to delivery.
Mm-hmm.
It masturbated to orgasm.
Really?
Yes.
Where did you read about that?
Good question. I have got to go through my files because now I can't remember where I got that.
Fascinating.
I was just like, are you kidding me? I mean, I figured the little boys are doing that before they're born because it's right there.
Yeah, yeah, and there's plenty of ultrasound stuff around boys masturbating in utero.
Yes, but a little girl.
Well, why not?
But a little girl. And so when you think about orgasm and sexual expression is so central to your identity as a living human being that you do it before you eat or breathe.
Mm-hmm. True.
And that's a nice segue into the whole idea of people who are who have, handicaps still thinking of themselves as sexual beings, even though the culture doesn't usually embrace that.
Right.
Do you want to talk a little bit about that and how one can get past some of those phobias and taboos?
Sure. Well, I mean, it's not easy, obviously, right? I mean, there's a lot of, and in fact, I mean, it's interesting. Some people have written a lot about the stigma of disability and actually the stigma of sex work as being very related. You know, the problem is that, it's what you've said. So the issue is that we are sexual. We're sexual from the moment we're born, and we're sexual till the moment we die, and that means different things for different people, but it's there. It's an energy that's there. And unfortunately, if you live with a disability, particularly, a visible disability, there's a big difference, often we'll sort of distinguish between visible disabilities, ones that you can see, and invisible ones. So things like early stage MS or epilepsy, or if you're hard of hearing, those are disabilities that you live with and really impact your life, but when you walk around, people don't necessarily know you have them. If you use a wheelchair, if you use crutches, if you talk different, if you think in a different way, that means you have to sort of process more slowly. This is stuff people perceive pretty obviously. And when you're when you fit into one of those categories, you basically have all of your sexual rights taken away. There really isn't, you know, people with disabilities really are the most sexually marginalized. So they're sort of, I mean, you know, because I know you're an activist, and so this is something that sort of makes sense. You know, people with disabilities in terms of sexual rights are kind of where gays and lesbians were 50 years ago. And I say that because the thing is, of course, you know, there is a disability rights movement, and it will change just as it did for gays and lesbians. But, you know, they are, you know, much more marginalized than, for example, people who are trans. And so what that means is, you know, again, from, you know, if you're born with a disability, pretty much from the moment you're born, you're, not only are your sexual rights taken away, but the possibility of you being sexual is taken away. And so how do you begin to feel, not only feel sexy, but even imagine a possibility of yourself being sexual? And that's really often what, you know, when people kind of write to us, or people come up and talk to us after we give talks about the book, often they're starting at that point. They're like, you know I have this thing, I know I have this desire, I know I want something, but I have no idea what it is. And that's actually, in some ways, although it's very difficult for people, from an educator's perspective, it's actually kind of exciting, because one of the things it means, and one of the real benefits of disability, is people are forced to define their sexuality on their own terms. They have no choice, right? The fact is that I look pretty much the way a guy is supposed to look, even though I don't really identify that much as a guy, and I don't feel very normal. The fact is that I could have the sex life that I'm supposed to, right? I could watch Oprah, and I could read fashion magazines, and I could, you know, find a woman to have sex with, and go through the motions and sort of pass as quote unquote normal. But I probably wouldn't be satisfied, and I think that describes a lot of people in this world, right? We go through these motions of we are sexual the way we're supposed to be. When you live with a disability, you can't, right? When you can't, you know, if you use a wheelchair to get around, or if you have to time medication in order to have an orgasm, you can't run down the beach, you can't roll in the waves, the big symphony isn't going to kind of sing for you. And so what you have to do is you have to figure out what sex means for you, which I think you'll agree is always a good thing.
And hopefully it doesn't always, you know, it's cyclical, I think, and should be changing. You should have the freedom
Absolutely.
To allow sex to be a kind of an evolving aspect of your life.
And really, I mean, when you live with a disability, you're kind of, I mean, depending on the disability, you're constantly reminded of that. You know, a good example is people who live with chronic pain. They always have to change, like, I mean, how they feel in their bodies and their ability to feel pleasure can change, like, in a minute or a second. One of the things, a very common problem, you know, people talk about if you live with pain is actually having sex, so having any kind of sex play. Often they'll be really into something and they'll get a pain, and immediately they have to stop. Like, for them, it takes them out of the sex right away.
Oh, my God. So towards the end of my marriage, my husband had developed chronic pain.
Mm-hmm.
And, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. And so,
it would be like, almost, and it seemed like a lot of times he would get a muscular spasm
mm-hmm,
that was completely debilitating just before the moment of orgasm.
Right. And so, I mean, imagine, well, you were there, you can't imagine the frustration of that. And also having to explain that to a partner and having a partner who can hang around for that. So, I mean, a lot of people who have sex with men will talk about the fact that they basically never get to have, you know, what they want to do is have an orgasm involving their male partner's erect penis.
Right.
And if that's what they want, that's great. And, you know, obviously that's not all of sex, but people have the right to have sex exactly how they want it.
Right.
But their partner's, like, constantly losing their erection because this sort of a start-stop sex. So,
yes.
So, but what it does, again, is it forces them to be creative. And certainly a lot of my friends and colleagues talk about, who live with disabilities, talk about the fact that their sex life is actually much better since they've had a disability. Now that's, you know, again, really depends on the disability. You know, something like chronic pain is very, very difficult to, it's really hard to have a good sex life and enjoy your sexuality because although it's not all in the body, so much of sex happens in the body, and the body becomes, for a lot of people with pain, just this really bad place.
Yeah, and it's basically what ended up happening for us a lot of times is that, of course, we had all kinds of tools and toys to make
mm-hmm.
sure I got wherever I needed to go.
Mm-hmm.
But he would, the pain was so excruciating that he'd just lose interest.
Right.
And I would, you know, I want to make you feel good too. That we'd often have that discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing was, is that actually the muscular tension involved in achieving an orgasm was what would throw him into spasms
pain.
And so
can I ask? So, were you able to kind of resolve it in some way, or did he find something that?
Well, we got divorced, but we're still occasional lovers. So, and medical marijuana has really been helpful for him.
Well, that's great.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's taken that edge off for him.
I mean, one of the hard things about talking about sex and disability is that people often want an answer, right? They want, like, how can I fix this? And there really is, there's no cookie-cutter solution to any of this stuff. It really is. I mean, that's the thing. The reason I like talking about sex and disability together is that it's exactly like, it's the way sexuality is, right? It's incredibly personal and subjective. So my message to people is always, like, there is a solution. There's a way of working around this. There's a way of you expressing your sexuality, but it will be completely unique to you, and it won't be an easy answer, which, of course, is what most of us want.
Yes, and then, of course, everything is always changing, too.
It's true.
So, and I like the way you started this conversation off. You said that you were non-disabled.
I said I'm currently non-disabled.
Yeah, currently.
Yeah.
And I thought that was interesting because it seemed like you were communicating this idea that there's not this hard and fast division between people who have fully functioning bodies and people who feel, who experience function loss.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, that's my experience of it, again, because disability is a big part of my life. And so, for example, I have occasionally sort of experienced this kind of nerve pain that's very debilitating. I'm really lucky that I haven't sort of had a flare-up in several years. But, you know, I mean, my mother, I guess it was like last year or 2 years ago, she fell and broke both of her wrists, and she was very disabled for about 6 months.
Yeah.
And for her, you know, it was this horrible thing where, for her, it was horrible because for the first little while she couldn't do anything, and so she needed help, in the toilet, in the bathroom.
Right.
And this was a bit mortifying for her, and there was a certain period of time where her partner, her husband, wasn't around, and so I helped her. And it's not an issue for me because it's just something that's part of my life that I'm used to. And I have to say, I mean, you know, this awareness of this experience that I've had, it's the same as what you said sort of earlier on about, you know, so much of what you know about sex is because you've got to not only have sex with a lot of people but see a lot of people be sexual, and you know that there are, you really know that there are millions of ways to do it, and that's a kind of knowledge that's so invaluable, and it's so hard to communicate, and I feel I have, you know, my experience with disability is the same. I mean, I'm very lucky because I get that I am currently non-disabled, and I don't, you know, if when I think about having a disability, I think about it as being a real big drag, but I know it won't be the end of my life. And it doesn't mean it won't be hard. I mean, it's not about minimizing, you know, the difficulty of living with a disability, but it's also about realizing that there are lots of ways to be.
Yes, yes, but I just really like that whole idea of a continuum too,
mm-hmm.
where it's not like it's us and them,
right?
Or you know, but rather because life does change, and
mm-hmm.
just, you know, we're all subject to the aging process, and there's
yes.
no telling what's going to happen as part of that.
That's right.
Even if, you know, you're spared some kind of like a major disease or a major injury,
mm-hmm.
there are still things that happen to people's sexuality as they age, and it's different for different people. I mean, that's one mythology I'd like to get away from, is the idea that if you are, you know, in your 50s and all of a sudden you have erectile dysfunction, that's just an inevitable aspect of the aging process.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not. There's guys in their 60s and 70s who don't have any problem with erections, if that's important to you.
Right.
But
there is this, as you said, there's this real mythology. I mean, there's this need to be able to predict everything, which is just, it's not the way it works. It's all very individual.
Well, it's not even, it's individual from day to day too.
That's
I find it frustrating how, like, performance and goal-oriented people have taken their sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, like in the workshops that I teach a lot of times, I try to encourage people to, you know, instead of trying to have an orgasm, why don't you try not to?
Right. I like it. I like it a lot. But that must piss people off.
Well, it's, yeah, it's not exactly, you know, I've already pissed them off by the time I insist they go into their relationship dynamics before they can get naked, so.
Oh, God, that's right.
What?
You're frustrating them left, right,
I don't understand. What is taking the garbage I have to do out with the fact that I wanted to get jiggy with it tonight?
Right. Oh, God.
It's like, well, it's everything's connected, that's what.
I know. People don't like, people don't want to hear that.
It's, you know, I think, maybe people will, at some point, they got to reach a point where we think where it's like, okay, this microwavable life that you're looking for,
mm-hmm.
just how satisfying could that possibly be?
I don't know. I mean, I hope you're right. I hope it changes. But, you know, we have, I mean, it's very American. I mean, I should say I'm Canadian. And it's also quite, this way the cultures aren't that different, but it's
yeah.
this mythology of independence, right? That we are all independent, that we all stand on our own. And it's just not true. We're not. We're interdependent.
Yes, we certainly are.
And that also ties to disability, because one of the real obstacles around, sort of social obstacles around living with a disability is that idea that if I need help, therefore I'm helpless, right? If I need help feeding myself,
right.
Well, how could I ever have sexual agency, right? Because to be a stud, you have to be able to throw someone down on the bed and rip your clothes off and whatever else you're supposed to do. When in fact, I mean, it's a myth. It, you know, it just isn't true. And someone might need help feeding themselves, but I need all sorts of help in my daily life. And
yeah.
So the sooner we...
But just reframing that.
Yeah.
You know, when you were talking about people with handicaps or lose their sexual rights,
mm-hmm.
I usually talk about how, you know, when I'm talking to my live audiences, I say, do you realize you don't have any sexual rights? And I address the whole idea that, you know, in the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, the one thing that is not guaranteed is the right to have sex.
That's right. That's true.
And mm-hmm. given that, I still think that you were probably pointing to a disparity between some of the things that perhaps people who have no disabilities take for granted.
Right.
Can you kind of enumerate those?
Yeah, I mean they're innumerable also almost. It starts with the basic right to be sexual. So, you know, even though you're right that it may not be the Constitution, it's understood in this culture that, you know, you go out in the world and if you walk around and you interact with someone, there may be flirtation. If you're being nice with them, nice to them, they may think, oh, we're being a bit flirtatious. That's sort of a possibility that's out there. If you're in a wheelchair, it's not a possibility that's out there. The possibility simply isn't there. You aren't someone who would be flirting with me or who I would flirt with. You're probably really good friend potential, but you have no, you know, sort of sex isn't an option for you.
Right.
In terms of sexual rights, I mean, there's some very basic ones, like, in fact, because of the ways that social services work and laws work, often it's basically difficult or impossible for people with disabilities to live together. If you live in an institution, if you live in any kind of group home or institutional setting, you actually aren't allowed to have sex with other people. In fact, you're usually not allowed to masturbate either.
They won't let you masturbate in an institution?
No, masturbation.
Why?
Is that. Well, I mean, again, these days...
So you can masturbate in the womb, but you can't masturbate in a hospital.
That's right, exactly. That's how screwed up everything is. Why? Because they don't want to deal with it. Because the nurses or the orderlies are going to say, I don't want to clean it up. It's not my job. They don't need to do that. They can learn to control themselves, right? Which, of course, is ridiculous. And it's what leads to what then all the people who work in institutions refer to as inappropriate sexual behavior. Because if you're not given the right to privacy, for example,
right.
If you're not given any proper sexual outlets, you'll be sexual somewhere else. So So you know, I mean, there's all sorts of other stories. I mean, like, so there's lots of stories that I've heard from people who will go, who have, like, visible disabilities, who actually will go to sex parties, particularly will go to BDSM parties, and actually be told that they're not allowed to play in public. Because, specifically because, you know, it's usually when the person with a visible disability is at the bottom, they're being told that that's just not appropriate, that if they have... If their partner, I guess in most of the stories that I know, the partner who's topping is non-disabled, but I'm not really sure that it would make a difference. The idea is that if you have a disability, it's not appropriate for you to want to experience pain or want to be, you know, I mean, sometimes it blows people's minds that someone who's paralyzed would ever want to be tied up. Because why would you want to be tied up? Because aren't you bound to your wheelchair? But the thing is, when you're paralyzed, you don't always experience it as being bound to your wheelchair. And it's very different, of course, choosing to be bound with
something.
There's
so much confusion around BDSM anyway.
That's
a service that I provided when I was an escort.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually, in 2004, I think it was, or maybe it was 2005, we created a slideshow with the client of mine who's in the wheelchair.
Okay.
So, and we started off doing Tantra, which we're praying together, and doing body worship and conscious breathing and chanting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very beautiful. At one point, he was working with my chakras, and I felt like I was levitating off the table.
Mm.
And this was somebody I'd known for, you know, he'd been a client of mine for like 10 years, so I had a really special heart connection. But we moved into BDSM because that's something he really enjoys.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, you know, dressed like a dominatrix, and I, you know, used a whip on him, and we put a hood on him so that he, you know, and he had to breathe out of a hose.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think the images, you know, are a little bit shocking for some people because
did you have
guy in a wheelchair.
Did you have experiences of showing people those images?
Oh, yes.
and did you get in a lot of trouble for it?
No, I haven't gotten into a lot of trouble because what I'm usually doing is introducing them to the whole concept of sacred prostitution.
Okay.
And they, the response is, I usually really enjoy this, I take it to the college students a lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
I show them the slideshow, and I just sit on the sidelines and watch their faces.
Mm-hmm.
And mostly it's just about their jaws dropping.
Right.
So they're kind of speechless.
Right.
And they can tell there's something really special going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, it's also... So I usually get questions like, what was that thing on his head, and why would he want to do that?
Right, exactly, yes.
Yeah.
And I mean, and certainly, of the many myths about sex and disability, one of them is that, I mean, there's the myth that people with disabilities are asexual, but then for those who are slightly more progressive, it's that, well, maybe they have sex, but they have very, very heterosexual, you know, what some people would call vanilla sex, right? And they wouldn't be into BDSM, they wouldn't be into fetishes, they wouldn't be into polyamory, they wouldn't be, you know, they just want, you know, kind of whatever.
Fluffy.
Fluffy sex.
Fluffy vanilla sex.
Exactly. So then another right, I guess, just to point out that people with disabilities don't have, I mean, the ways that their rights are taken away are by, you know, I mean, one example, particularly for teens living with disabilities, often their primary caregivers are their parents. And so the parent, you know, the ways that we learn to be sexual when we're not around our parents are important. They're not always good, but they're important. If you rely on your parents for everything, for taking you to and from school, for getting you out of bed, you know, it's hard to hide porn under your bed when your parents are always in there. And if you rely on, attendants are another example. So people who use attendant care, meaning, you know, that's someone that they hire to cook their meals or to help them get dressed or whatever it is that they need. Attendants will often refuse to do things related to sex. So if you are, let's say you're like a bio man, but you like to cross-dress, and this is a story that I've heard, which is that the guy who likes to cross-dress and uses a power chair, he has no use of his arms or legs, and his attendants wouldn't, not only would they not dress him up in women's clothing, which is what he wanted, which is their job. It's their job to dress him. And they would dress him in men's clothing, but not in women's clothing. But in fact, some of them wouldn't even, when they were out on the street and he would go by a women's clothing store, he'd want to just look at the window, like window shop, and some of them wouldn't even do that.
Yes.
And what they can do is they can just keep pushing his chair, right? So, I mean, he has no rights there.
I get it. So he's infantilized.
Yeah.
Basically, he's everybody's child.
That's right. And of course, it's what, I mean, parents are already prone to do that with their kids anyway, and
right.
they tend to do it much more with their kids with disabilities. And it's not out of any, I mean, it's not out of meanness. It's just out of, you know, I mean, often instead of desire to protect them. I mean, this is a whole other interesting discussion around disability is around sort of, what they sometimes call dignity of risk, which is that, you know, as autonomous adults or not even just as adults, but youth also have to do it, we have the right to take risks. You know, we sometimes take bad risks and it doesn't work out well, but in fact, it's our right. As long as we're not, you know, going out there and coercing someone else to do something and not hurting someone else, it's part of our rights. And of course, it's a really important developmental piece at any stage of your life, is to take risks, and sometimes they work and sometimes they don't, and you always learn from them. We tend to not let people with disabilities take any risks, right? We don't want them to get hurt. And this is very much that kind of thing that you get from parents, but also well-meaning friends, and it's like, I'm not going to go to a bar with this friend because they're just going to get turned down, and I don't want them to get hurt that way. But the fact is that people with disabilities have as much a right to get turned down and said no to and hurt as anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of life. Being rejected is part of life, but we tend to be, you know, tend to treat them with such kid gloves, and that's not doing anyone any favors. Really, the goal should be that the person with a disability is treated essentially the same as everyone else in terms of their rights. Being egalitarian, it's not the same as being equal. It's not that we don't treat people differently based on their different needs. I would offer to help someone who asked for help, if they asked for it. Now I'm just rambling.
I know. The hard part for so many people is that, you know, based upon visual cues,
mm-hmm.
people make a whole list of assumptions.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, whether it's gender or race or socioeconomic, you know, category,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
or whether or not,
yeah.
you know, you're perceived as having some kind of an illness.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Age, there's all these barriers, and people make a lot of assumptions about what is and isn't possible for you.
It's true. I mean, it's a really hard thing. So one of the other things I do is that I'm a worker owner at a sex store in Toronto called Come As You Are, and because people know that I do a lot of stuff around disability and the store is fully accessible, so we have a lot of customers with disabilities, and we also have a lot of customers with disabilities who call. And one of the interesting things that happens, at a sex store, you get crank calls, obscene phone calls all the time.
Yeah.
One of the tricky things, though, is that a lot of people with different kinds of disabilities end up sounding like obscene phone callers. So someone might be breathing really heavy,
right.
But that's because that's the way they breathe.
Or
people that have lost a vocal cord or lost strength in their vocal cords often will kind of talk in a raspy voice.
Right.
Or sometimes people just, the phone rings, they pick up the phone and say, "Hello, Come As You Are," and the other person doesn't respond right away.
Yeah.
And it's really, I mean, we're really careful about training our staff to not make those kinds of assumptions. But it's hard sometimes because if you've had three guys call saying, like, you know, "Talk to me about your crotchless panties," you know, you get a little frustrated.
No. Well, this actually sounds like something any business owner should be aware of.
Yes.
Because, you know, whether you're calling for crotchless panties or a pizza, if you can't speak over the phone like you're expected to,
right?
You might not be able to get service. You'd lose a customer.
True, it's very true.
Corey, I'm going to just check in with the listeners here for a minute and remind everybody that this is actually a call-in show. So if you have a story about our topic tonight, which is handicaps and sex, feel free to call in. Or if you've got a question about it, please call in. And here's the numbers. Our direct line is 530-876-3222. That's 530-876-3222. And then toll-free in both U.S. and Canada is 888-815-3222. 888-815-9756. Once again, the toll-free number for U.S. and Canada is 888-815-9756. And for our Canadian listeners, Corey, tell us a little bit about that story again, Come As You Are.
So, yeah, it's called Come As You Are, and we have a website, which is it's spelled C-O-M-E, spelled Come the Classy Way, A-S-Y-O-U-A-R-E, so just comeasyouare.com. And we are, I guess we're actually now in our 12th year, and we were very much based on the Good Vibrations model of the time 12 years ago, which is that we are a worker cooperative. So we're now the only worker cooperative sex store in the world.
Wow.
Because Good Vibrations, well, they stopped being a co-op and then they stopped being owned by the same people. And
God, I didn't even know that.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. There's been a lot of change in Good Vibrations.
Oh, wow.
It's
been a while since I've done a workshop there. Well, actually, not that long, only 2 years.
Well, there's still lots of all the great people working in the stores are still there. So on the floor for customers, I don't think the change is really evident.
Okay.
But they're not a co-op anymore. They're not democratic, and they're like kind of a regular business.
Okay.
So Come As You Are is a democratically run worker cooperative. And so we're sort of a sex store in the vein of stores like Good Vibrations and others. So we identify ourselves as feminist. We don't sell, we don't sell novelties or anything like that. It's just a lot of really good sex toys and books and videos.
Uh-huh.
And we have a real focus around disability. So our retail store, which is in Toronto, is fully accessible.
What are some of the kind of things that people with handicaps might find at your store that they couldn't find somewhere else?
Well, partly is that our toy buyers, they have an eye for sex toys that are more accessible. So we have a lot of things that will work for a lot of people with mobility disabilities.
Okay.
So vibrators either that are easy to strap on your hand or ones that are easy to turn on and off, so you just sort of have to press them down. We don't have, there aren't really, sometimes people say like, they'll come in and say like, show me the toys for people with disabilities. And my response is sort of like, well, there are no, that's sort of like saying, show me the toys for Jewish people.
Yeah.
I say that because I'm Jewish. And so, there aren't any toys specifically, they don't make toys for specific groups like that.
Yes.
But what we carry, you'll find in a lot of good sex stores. The difference is sort of the service, is that, all of our staff are well trained to sort of think about disability and talk about disability and be comfortable with disability.
Now, since you're online, people can order from anywhere.
That's right. Yeah, they can order from anywhere in the U.S. or Europe. I know that we order, it's like North America and Europe.
Okay. And so you have an email on the website so where people could, maybe say, hey, I was recently injured or I was recently diagnosed with something and I'm not entirely sure how to be sexual now.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, and that's one of the nice things is that Come As You Are actually supports all my education work. So people can email and get their questions answered for free. They don't have to buy anything. And if they want to buy stuff, then they can too. But one of the big differences being a co-op is that our primary mandate is not about selling people stuff.
Right.
We found that we're good enough at what we do that people buy lots of stuff anyway, so we've survived for 12 years. but we're really able to give products and services in the context of education and not have to sort of say, this is the thing to buy. Because often sex toys aren't the answer. I mean, sex toys can be a lot of fun, and I'm a big fan, and I wouldn't own a sex store if I wasn't, but for some people it's not a sex toy. It's just a different sexual practice.
Oh, my sex toy is a very important member of my family.
I feel the same. Now, so what? Now, do you have a favorite sex toy?
Well, you know what? It used to be a rabbit pearl.
Okay, good.
That was my very first one, and I burned my way through about a half a dozen of those.
Excellent. But now has that changed? You said it used to be the rabbit.
Yeah, pearl. I'm kind of into the Hitachi now.
It's very good. The Hitachi Magic Wand changed my life.
Oh, do tell.
Well, yeah, I got my first magic wand. It was my first trip to San Francisco, and I went to Good Vibrations, and was very nervous and very excited. And the reason it changed my sex life was that, because a lot of guys, I mean, the way that I learned to be sexual involved a lot of friction, right? So it was masturbating using my hand and rubbing up and down,
right.
Or it's rubbing against things, but with a lot of intensity. And the first time I used a magic wand, you can actually just take a magic wand, put it wherever feels good. So in my case, if you just put it sort of around the head of the penis, and I had an orgasm. And I had an orgasm without moving the wand, without anything. And I had no idea my body could do that. I, you know, to me, and I was probably, I don't know how old I was, sort of, I was late teens. You know, I thought the way that, I mean, this is the way I think a lot of guys think in particular, is that the way that it works is the way that it works. It doesn't do anything else.
Right. Right?
There's only one way. I mean, you know, this is the kind of the myth. The terrible thing about male sexuality is that so many guys come into our store and aren't interested in sex toys because they say, I know how to do it, right? I know how to masturbate. And it's like, yes, you do, but do you know that there's 1,000 other ways to do it? And they're fun, too? And so that was really, I mean, the magic wand was really the thing that, like, opened my eye to the fact that my body, that you know, before then, because I had grown up in a pretty sexually permissive environment, my father was a sex therapist, I knew that your mind, I had a huge sexual fantasy life, and I knew that your mind could kind of do a lot of different things, but I really thought that your body was sort of destiny, that, like, that there was one way to have an orgasm. And in about 30 seconds, I discovered I was wrong.
The first time I saw a man use a vibrator,
mm-hmm.
he was putting it at the base of his penis, not
yeah.
the head,
mm-hmm.
and using that to achieve multiple orgasms.
Mm-hmm.
So he was orgasming without an erection and without ejaculation.
Right, right.
From the base of his penis. And again, you know, this first person being there to watch it and go, oh,
yeah.
So that's what a multiple orgasm looks like for men.
Right, exactly.
And you know, and it's not about being able to get it up over and over again in quick, you know, succession, which is what a lot of men will think. Oh, that's a multiple orgasm. It's like, no, you're not.
No, I know.
You know, this is disassociating your orgasm from erections and
mm-hmm.
ejaculation
mm-hmm.
entirely. And I mean, those things are nice, but they're not necessary.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing I love is the magic banana. Do you carry those?
You know, I don't. We don't. Do you mean the little yellow rope thing?
Yes, it's shaped like a loop.
That's
and
right. And you know, she's Canadian.
Oh no, I didn't know that.
Yeah, she is. We did a long time ago, and then I don't know. I'm not really sure why we don't anymore. But I do know it. So you really like it?
Well, the thing I like about it is that it's subtle. So and plus, it's really small. It goes in very easy,
mm-hmm.
but it expands.
Mm-hmm.
And gives you a sense of fullness, but it's a real subtle feeling of fullness.
Mm-hmm.
So when you actually start to have an orgasm, and your pubococcygeal muscles are clamping down on the magic banana,
mm-hmm.
it's like this gentle stroking.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it moves around a little bit, so you get like this added dimension of stimulation internally.
That's cool. I didn't even know that it was still around. It was it was a long time ago that I first heard about it. And I remember, I think she was like Kingston, Ontario.
Oh, wow.
And
no, I didn't hear about it until, I guess, probably about 2 years back.
And do you remember where you
I was up in Seattle.
Yeah.
And a friend of a marriage and family therapist told me about it.
Okay.
She's a marriage and family therapist, but she just teaches nothing but workshops about sex. Her name is Terry Chalky, and
okay.
Yeah, she's a therapist up in Seattle, Washington, who was teaching this wonderful workshop called the Clitoral Truth.
Oh right, which
she had live models and everything.
Nice.
And we were exploring the G spot and everything. But anyway, I do believe she's the one that told me about the magic banana, and
okay.
I had to get one. I was like, that and a Hitachi wand, and I'm set.
Right. Well, we all see them. We all tend to find our favorites. Some people, I have some friends that are huge collectors, and they like to have different dildos for like different times of day and stuff. But
yes,
but
I have little fun ones that I travel with.
Yes.
You can't take the big wand in, you know, your suitcase.
No. Although it's funny. I'm giving at the end of the week. I'm giving a workshop in New Orleans at ASECT, and so I've actually shipped my whole box of sex toys there because.
Oh, cool!
It was actually too heavy. But usually, I travel with the sex toys, and the customs people usually just laugh a lot at me. I mean, I kind of look like I'm a bank teller, so they don't perceive me as being very threatening.
I'll bet. Mm-hmm. I'll bet that's a real hoot.
Mm-hmm.
We're coming up against the hour here, so
okay.
I wanted to share with you an experience that I had. Maybe you have some comments about it. But when I was working as an escort. A man came to see me who was born without any arms or legs.
Mm-hmm.
His mother had taken thalidomide.
Okay.
So he had just little tiny flippers
mm-hmm.
for arms and legs.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being a little bit freaked out at first.
Mm-hmm.
I had seen a lot, you know, people in wheelchairs, people missing legs, people missing half of their penis,
mm-hmm.
but I'd never seen somebody who basically was a head and a torso.
Mm-hmm.
And, but, you know, I got into bed with this man. He had the most piercing blue eyes, one of the happiest people I've ever met.
Mm-hmm.
And it took forever for him to get all the leg crutches and arm crutches off and,
mm-hmm.
and get up into bed, but when we got there, I closed my eyes, and he was, like, stroking my shoulder and my neck with his flipper.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember just relaxing into that sensation and realizing that skin is skin.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very erotic.
Mm-hmm.
And so just, like, as a parting commentary to our listeners, can you talk a little bit about sexiness?
Well, I mean, it's a great story. I mean, you know, I mean, this is, and the thing is that, I mean, I think that it's, I mean, yeah, I just want to sit and think about that story for a second. I mean,
yeah.
You know, what I like about it is...
It was a life-changing thing for me.
Yeah, it is that, I mean, I think it's great to have that awareness that this is weird and that you are freaked out, but then to be able to kind of breathe through it. You know, the thing that I think is so powerful about talking about sex and disability is that it forces us to get to the point of what is sexy and what is erotic. And the fact is that we do hinge in our culture on these sort of stereotypes or these sort of tropes about, like, the chiseled chest or the ability to be really spontaneous or, you know, I mean, sort of all these kind of images, being young and being free and being high and being whatever it is.
Right.
And, you know, some of those things may be what is erotic for some of us. I think that anyone who, and I mean, you know, I think you'll probably agree with me, I mean, anyone who really spends time either thinking about their own sexuality or listening to other people talk about their sexual experiences will know that most of that stuff is just total bullshit, right? That it's not, that stuff isn't what, you know, when you get someone behind a closed door, what turns them on, it's invariably it's a bit weird and off and kinky and strange and them. And you know, and the thing is that we all have that, right? You know, when we talk about the fact that we're all sexual, it isn't just a line, right? That if you take, you know, as you did, if you take a moment and open yourself up to that experience, you know, you will experience, I mean, I believe you will experience anyone as sexual. You will see their sexuality, to the extent that, I mean, it sounds like the other piece of that story is, of course, that guy was already there. I mean, he was able to be sexual with you.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And to know, I mean, he had sexual agency.
He
did. He was in touch with his own sexuality. That's what turned him on.
He had always been the way he was physically.
Yeah.
And you could tell that, there, you know, somehow he was able to work past other people's perceptions
mm-hmm.
of him.
Mm-hmm.
But he himself, I mean, there was, like, you know, no irritation about having to deal with, you know, the absence of arms and legs, because that's all he'd ever known.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He was just really, really comfortable in mm-hmm. his own skin.
And you were, you know, I mean, the thing is, I mean, you know, to be able to experience him as sexy, it was, I mean, as you're describing, I mean, it was an experience. It's this thing about getting over the other stuff. What I like to think is that there's an essential connection there. That in our, if there was such a thing as a natural state, we would be able to connect with each other that way. And that the problem is that we just have a lot of, you know, a lot of walls and a lot of crap in between us and that other person.
I hope someday that human beings realize that they're not birds.
Mm-hmm.
Birds operate very much on visual cues,
mm-hmm.
color of feathers, all that.
Mm-hmm.
We're not birds.
No.
We need to get over what we look like.
I agree.
Anyway, Corey, it's really been fun talking to you.
Well, it's been my pleasure.
And I hope you'll come back and visit us another time.
Absolutely, I will.
Okay, you want to tell us one more time the name of that book and
sure.
where we can get a copy?
So the book is called The Ultimate Guide to Sex and Disability, and it's published by Cleus Press. And it's available online at Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all the big bookstores. And most good sex stores also carry it. And it's also available on our website, which is just comeasyouare.com, which is comeasyouare.com.
Cool.
Great.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
Have a nice night.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.
Veronica Monet offers help, healing, and hope in the form of private telephone sessions. Email Veronica at sexwithoutshame.com to schedule an appointment, or visit www.sexwithoutshame.com to find out what Veronica can do for you.